The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2007 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown Los Angeles as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit www.aloudla.org.
In her new book, The Terror Dream, Susan Faludi asks pressing questions. Why did our culture respond to an assault against American global dominance with a frenzied summons to restore traditional values? Why, she asked, did we react as if the hijackers had not hit office towers and military headquarters, but our own white picket fences? Why, in the week after 9/11, were only 5 of the 88 opinion pieces in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times written by women? Feminist commentator Katha Pollitt, interviewed in the LA Times recently, suggests that Faludi's book is, quote, a very important wake-up call to voters about the risks of getting caught up in a kind of warlike fearfulness. Faludi asks tough questions, and she's well qualified to ask them and well equipped to dig for the answers. She's a native New Yorker, and she is the author of Stiffed, The Betrayal of the American Man, and Backlash, The Undeclared War Against American Women, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. She's written for many publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Nation, and we're very pleased to have her here tonight. In conversation with Ms. Faludi tonight is Kit Rackless, editor-in-chief of Los Angeles Magazine. Kit served as arts editor of the Boston Phoenix, executive editor of the Village Voice, editor-in-chief of the LA Weekly, and senior projects editor at the Los Angeles Times. Under his tenure, I'm sure you're all familiar with Los Angeles Magazine, which is a marvelous magazine, which has been nominated for 4 National Magazine Awards and has won more city and regional magazine awards than any other magazine. It's always a pleasure to have Kit here as a moderator. Would you please welcome Susan Faludi and Kit Rackless to Aloud.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad you're all here. As Louise introduced the book, our guest tonight has written, I think, one of the most important books since September 11th, and certainly one of the most provocative. She is not only going against the grain of contemporary culture, but she is challenging it in very fundamental ways. And so I thought we would begin by, for you to outline broadly sort of the thesis of the book, so that everybody here who hasn't read it, but will read it, we'll have a context for the rest of our conversation.
Great. Thank you all for coming. It's a real deja vu to be here. My last book, Stiffed, I researched. I was living in LA at the time, and I spent many days in the library here. This is actually only my second time in this room. Usually I was in the stacks. Where to begin on this book? It really began as a question, a sort of persistent and nagging question of why did we react in the particular and peculiar way we reacted? Because after 9/11, I just, as the weeks and months went by, I noticed all of these very odd, anomalous responses. It was almost as if we had fallen into some kind of strange fever dream where our political leaders were reenacting the Wild West on in the old frontier and talking about, there was all this vigilante rhetoric about smoke them out of their holes and shoot them between the eyes. And the pundits from Atlantic Monthly to the Washington Post were talking about how this was really back. The war on terror was going back to our frontier days, and it was like taming the frontier, and it was all about a return to fight to our Indian wars. And then at the same time, we had the media churning out these stories about how this was going to be a return to traditional family arrangements, that there was going to be a marriage boom, a baby boom, that women were going to return to nesting and homemaking and, in the words of Time magazine, sewing their own drapes and dresses.
And it was also the end of irony, too, if I recall correctly.
It was also what?
The end of irony, yes, famously. Right.
I know. Well, I guess in that aspect, it truly was. You know, you kept reading this thinking, surely, where does it say joke at the bottom? And, you know, and John Wayne kept coming up. There were these stories about how it was the return of the manly man, the return of a sort of John Wayne style manhood. You probably remember the Peggy Noonan article, "Welcome Back, Duke." You know, from the ashes of 9/11 arise the manly virtues, men who push things and pull things and tell everyone else where to go. A quote that I have trouble getting out of my head, clearly. So I, perplexed by all this, I wondered, you know, why were we reacting in this way? You know, as Louise was saying in the introduction, here we had been attacked by hijackers who had aimed their planes at the symbols of commercial and military power, yet we were acting as if they had attacked the home and hearth. You know, on top of that, here we've been attacked by people who hate Western women's liberation, yet our media was urging women to go back to the home, and there were actually an alarming number of articles about how 9/11 proved that feminism was frivolous, irrelevant, and even unpatriotic. So it seemed as if we were reacting not to the actual threat at hand, but to some buried threat, something hidden in our national experience. And so I set out to sort of piece this together, and that I ended up chasing this mystery into history and into our earliest history.
And before we go into that, could you tell us sort of, you know where, because this is an early and important part of the book, you know, where you were 9/11, how you reacted to it, you know, what was it, you know, is a, you know, nothing that is purely personal, but what was your absolutely personal sort of response in the context of that day?
Well, I have a very odd story. I was in Los Angeles. I was living in Beechwood Canyon, and I had this dream. I always hesitate to say this because I'm not the sort of person who you know, believes in kind of New Age woo-woo dreams. I think I was voted most cynical girl in the dorm in college. But nonetheless, for whatever reason, on the morning, you know, early morning here, I had this very striking dream that I was on an airplane, and I was sitting next to another woman who I didn't know, and two young men came up the aisle, and one of them had a pistol that he held to my throat and shot once, and then shot once again to the woman next to me, and the bullets went in at this sort of odd angle that, you know, later I would connect in my fevered imagination with the Twin Towers. But in the dream, I thought to myself, well, this is odd. I'm still alive, and this woman here seems to be alive, but neither of us can speak. And then I woke up and sort of disgorged this dream to my common-law husband, and trying to get it out of my mind. And then the phone rang, and it was a friend who's actually was at the LA Times at the time, calling me to say, have you, you know, do you know what's going on? Turn on your television. So anyway, I don't think I have any great oracular powers, but what struck me later was the sort of metaphorical properties of this dream on several levels, both most sort of specifically the silencing of women that happened after 9/11. Something that, you know, I don't think has been pointed out enough, that there, in the weeks after 9/11, there was a notable decline in the proportion of women in writing op-eds on talk shows. In the first 7 weeks after the attacks, female guests on those important Sunday morning news programs dropped by 40%. And not just, you know, because women were not part of the discussion. Even really important newsmakers who you would think would be invited, for example, Feinstein and Boxer, who were heads of congressional subcommittees dealing with terrorism, made no appearances on the show. Feminist critics like Katha Pollitt, Susan Sontag, if you call her a feminist, but certainly someone who's seen as a, you know, very strong, forceful woman, writer and speaker and analyst, Barbara Kingsolver, the novelist, the list goes on. There were any woman who dissenter was leaped on in a way that was peculiar to women. While, you know, certainly Bill Maher and there were male critics who were criticized, women were criticized in this very, you know, shut down in this very personal and moralistic way. You probably remember Susan Sontag be called morally deranged, an idiot. I mean, the kind of just insulting language. Katha Pollitt was called a bad mother. You know, there was sort of this focus on gender. So there was that. There was that level of silencing. But then, but more broadly, there was a sort of self-censorship and an inability on the part of the American public to express what 9/11 meant to us. I mean, it was almost as if it rang this distant bell clearly. We were talking about it in these frontier terms, but we couldn't seem to make sense of it. So there was sort of a larger way in which 9/11 was sort of stuck in our throats.
And the second half of the book, which is really wonderful, is your exploration of this kind of myth. You say that we reverted back to perhaps one of the oldest myths in American history, which is the frontier is fear of savages and where strong men protected women. And you cite any number of historians and explore that history or that myth and in great detail and with kind of great narrative sort of verve. Describe a number of sort of incidents. I mean, there's the Deerfield Massacre, which, if you live in New England, is really well known. and you talk about the Salem witch trials. Could you talk about that history? Because it's really one of the great parts of the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, as much as we heard over and over after 9/11 that this was something that had never, these sort of attacks had never happened to us before as a culture, that you know, America is not vulnerable to assault on home soil. And in recent times, that's largely the case. But if we look at our earliest history, we realize something very important, that this has happened to us before, over and over. And its happening was essential to the formation of our national character. For the first two centuries, the central reality and pervading reality of colonial and early American life was being attacked on quote-unquote home soil. Needless to say, this was home soil that Anglo settlers had taken from the Native American population. Nonetheless, from the point of view of the settlers, they felt that they were under attack by people they regarded and demonized as non-Christian, non-white, quote-unquote terrorists, a term that was actually employed. And these were attacks specifically on villages, on communities. They were aimed at the home and hearth. Moreover, they were attacks in which While we remember our image of the frontier is, you know, John Wayne prevailing at the end of every reel of every 1950s Western we've ever seen, the reality in this period from the 17th century through the middle of the 18th century is of male leaders, militias, husbands not able again and again to protect their families in the frontier towns. The leaders, out of negligence or mistaken strategy or utter ineptitude, and similarly with the militia, or there weren't enough of them, or the husbands were out in the fields. But in any event, over and over, this was the story. On top of that, male settlers suffered the further mortification of women defending themselves or announcing it in the classic captivity narratives of the period, which were all of the bestsellers of the first century and a half, with the exception of Pilgrim's Progress, were captivity narratives, often written by women talking about how they had been abducted, and how they had defended themselves, how they negotiated. Mary Rowlandson, the most famous of the captivity narratives, both going into detail about how she had shrewdly negotiated with her captors and bartered with her sewing skills, and ultimately named her own ransom. Or Hannah Dustin, who was also a very well-known figure at the time in Puritan society for having been abducted from her child bed a few days after giving birth to her 12th child. Her husband kind of ran in from the field as the Indians were coming in, saw them coming through the door, and then ran out again. And she and her midwife were taken captive and marched 150 miles in a matter of days. And at some point she decided she had had enough of this and instructed her midwife and another little boy who was also with them at the time that when she gave the high sign, they were to pick up hatchets and they were going to get out of there. And she killed 10 Indians and took their scalps for the bounty, and traipsed back to Boston to demand her money. So these were the sort of stories that were circulating at the time, and there were also stories of women who were just either not rescued. More by one estimate, between the late 17th century and the early 18th century, more than a quarter of female captives taken in New England towns were never rescued, and a kind of stunning 60% of girls were never rescued. And then on top of that, there were, by one estimate, a third of female captives, when given the opportunity to return, refused. They preferred Indian life. So this was all, this, none of this fit into the frame of the traditional, patriarchal family structure. And at a certain point, this became certainly more than the Puritan male establishment could stomach, which is partly where the Salem witch trials story comes in.
Do two things. Talk about the Salem witch trials, but also I think it's also important to talk about how historically those captivity tales get transformed into American mythology. So,
your
order, whatever you prefer.
What did we do? I mean, the question is what did we do with these stories? And beyond the stories, what do we do with our feeling as a culture of feelings of vulnerability, of fear, of this sort of period of perpetual insecurity in what frontier historian Richard Slotkin called, quote, an atmosphere of terror? And what we did was essentially, as a culture over, you know, the next century and a half, starting in the 18th century, really culminating by the end of the Victorian era, was to paper it over with this domestic myth of ourselves as triumphal rescuers, this myth of American invincibility and indomitable powers of security. So these stories, I mean, in our culture, and by that I mean our, you know, our journalists, our novelists, our artists, our sculptors, our politicians, created, rewrote and rewrote these accounts so that male strength was sort of extracted, the stories of male weakness were turned into a kind of exaggerated ironclad valor, and the stories of female strength were either derided or turned into exaggerated helplessness. So to take the case of Hannah Duston, in the 19th century, a series of very prominent literary figures recast this story and denounced Hannah Duston. Most famously, Nathaniel Hawthorne declared Hannah Duston a bloody old hag who should have drowned in the river on her way home, and should, you know, wish she should just be eliminated from the history books. And then Thomas Duston, her husband, he recast as this mighty hero on horseback who had run out the door to save his children and got his musket and slaughtered untold Indians. This is all based not on anything in the historical record, but simply Hawthorne's fevered imagination. To go back to the Salem witch trials, which I keep building up to, there are many ways to look at the Salem witch trials, which is why it's endlessly fascinating. And this is, I don't mean to reduce it to just one aspect, because there are plenty, you know, there are all kinds of, community tensions, rise of mercantilism. There were many forces that led to the trials. But one aspect that is striking and that I explored in the book was that if you look at who the witches were and who the possessed girls were, you see a story in which if you look demographically at who the witches were, as feminist scholars have done in the last 25, 30 years, what you see is women who were strong, opinionated, independent, among the executed female witches, when most of them were female, 89% of them had no male heirs. So they had their own money that they weren't handing down to a male, that weren't going into male hands. And they were challenging by and large, these were people who challenged the male establishment, who refused to give up their economic independence. The girls, of course, were girls, and they were weak and compliant and hysterical. And the Puritan establishment, which hardly gave women a voice normally, suddenly said it was fine for them to be screaming and yelling in church and in court. The other interesting thing about the witch trials is that new scholarship that again has come out of feminist scholarship in the last decade or so, in particular Mary Beth Norton's book *In the Devil's Snare*, talks about how this was connected to the early Indian Wars. That when you look at the backgrounds of the girls who claimed to be bewitched, who were doing the accusing, vast majority of them had been orphaned in the Indian Wars, and the judges in the witch trials, the majority of them had an uncomfortable embarrassing hand in failing to protect some of the frontier outposts, particularly in the Second Indian War and King William's War. And so there was by that reading, the Salem witch trials become a kind of reenactment, a rewriting of the story of failure of protection, failed protection effort, and it becomes instead a story of these judges and the Puritan patriarchs and Cotton Mather especially rescuing these girls. If they couldn't rescue them from the Indian attacks, they're rescuing them now from these spectral forces who take human form as the witches, as the women of the strong, powerful women.
One of the examples, modern examples you use for our sort of recycling this myth, is Steven Spielberg's The War of the Worlds, and which you compare to The Searchers. Talk about that example and talk about other examples of that in pop culture and what you think they said is in kind of post 9/11 America.
Well, actually, one of my little light bulbs going off that led me to write the book was I was actually in Sweden at the time of the British terrorist attack in the London subways, and so I was reading the British press and watching BBC, and it struck me how their reaction was so different, that they, they basically treated it as a criminal matter, and there was certainly—I mean, not that I saw anyway—any talk about how this was going to put hair on the chest of the British, average British man, or return women to baking scones or making tea, and so that's a day or two after I ended up, because it was very hot, unusually hot day in Stockholm, thanks to global warming, no doubt. We took refuge in a movie theater, and then War of the Worlds was playing. And it was so informed by 9/11. I mean, those of you who have seen it know there are all these missing posters, and it's all set in this New Jersey, New York area. And people video with their video cameras. I mean, it's clearly 9/11 is kind of seeping in through the cracks of this movie, and yet it's a story where this experience of being in this case intergalactic attack of is turned into the American domestic drama where Tom Cruise is rescuing his little girl, not only from Martians, but from a molester, and then returning her to the arms of, the bower of the family. And there's this final scene that's straight out of The Searchers, The Searchers, the 1956 John Ford classic, where John Wayne rescues little Debbie, played by Natalie Wood, and returns her, Pieta style to the homestead. And then, the lights went up in this Stockholm theater, and I look around, and I know this was like a blockbuster back home, and there are about four people in the audience, and they're all just yawning and looking like this was very tedious and had no idea why any American would watch this. What struck me about The Search, why were we returning to the story of The Searchers and the story of the invincible John Wayne? Clearly, it was a fiction that was really important and consoling to us.
One of the stories and one of the key chapters in your book is Jessica Lynch, a captivity story that is entirely manufactured by the Pentagon. I don't know if it makes sense, but maybe you could read something from that chapter and then talk about how and why you think the Pentagon created the Jessica Lynch story completely at odds with what really happened and who she was.
Right. Well, you all probably remember Jessica Lynch a private and a maintenance company that participated in the early days of the, you know, the first weeks of the Iraq War. And on the mad dash to Baghdad, her unit, which was a support unit and was supposed to be guarded by combat units, was left behind. Then there, her commanding officer managed, despite his GPS system and various forms of maps and a special, like, detailed map on a CD and in multiple briefings, managed to take about 14, I'm exaggerating, about 8 wrong turns, and wound up, they wound up in the outskirts of Nasiriyah, where they were ambushed, and a third of her unit was killed. There were 5 who were taken hostage. She was horribly injured in this accident when her Humvee hit a jackknife tractor trailer. So, and she was taken to the, wound up at this Iraqi hospital. So the story, of course, went from the military that there was this, all these crackerjacks, special ops teams with all this fancy weaponry that, you know, raided the hospital after midnight. He had this huge battle to get in and rescued her from bloodthirsty Fedayeen death squads. Well, and the army, the military put out a videotape of this 3 hours after the raid and rousted all the journalists who were covering the early days of the war out of their beds so they could watch this this little film. And in reality, she, you know, there was no battle. They were in and out in 6 minutes without a casualty. There were no bloodthirsty Fedayeen death squads, as the military knew.
She was being taken care of by an Iraqi pharmacist, right?
Or? She was being cared for. You know, it was just a bunch of doctors and nurses in there who were caring for her and actually were trying to return her to the U.S. military 2 days before the raid. They bundled her into an ambulance and took her to, were trying to bring her back, and they hit a checkpoint where Marines started shooting so fiercely at them that they had to turn around and bring her back to the hospital. So, within the last year, there has been a certain amount of debunking of the Jessica Lynch story on the grounds of, well, did she use her gun or didn't she? Was she brave or wasn't she? But one, you know, key area that hasn't been explored is the way that the media seized upon this story and worked very hard to remake her from, a soldier who had enlisted not once but twice into this frail little girl who needed rescue. And so I think, shall I read just a couple paragraphs of how that transformation came about? We cast our male soldiers returning from the war zone as battle-tested, seasoned, tougher, old beyond their years. But the post-war Lynch would be lauded not for her hard-won maturity, but for having remained a girl. Her virtue lay in her preserved and aspic innocence. She hasn't changed one bit, a typical media report assured, after consulting with her kindergarten teacher. The celebration of her perpetual childhood began immediately with media accounts from the military hospital in Germany that described her as the tiny girl and the blonde waif. She was said to be, quote, clutching a teddy bear. She was said to favor applesauce and steamed carrots. She was said to be dreaming of washing her hair and styling it with a curling iron. She was said to be, quote, asking for her mother. Stateside, reporters flocked to Palestine, West Virginia, to harvest sugar and spice details from kindergarten teachers and grade school playmates. Her grandmother, the media reported, called her Precious Little Jessie. Little Jessie was, according to various dispatches, a, quote, princess laying out her clothes every night, a wannabe beauty queen who liked her hair ribbons to match her outfits, and a little girl who loved pink dresses and perfect hair. We learned that she once fractured her arm and insisted on a pink cast to go with her pink shoelaces, used to play with Barbies, presided as the Work County Fair's Miss Congeniality, couldn't hit the ball at all in softball, wore small-waisted dresses, and was every mother's dream of a teenage daughter. When former New York Times reporter Rick Bragg sat down to write his biography on Lynch some months later, called I Am a Soldier Too, he devoted a chapter titled Princess to the enumeration of her maidenly attributes. The chapter's first sentence begins, "Her bangs were always perfect." The biography of a good girl follows. She was born, quote, tiny and beautiful, a doll-like little girl who was, quote, almost as quiet as one and never any trouble. She cried her first day or so in Linda Davies' kindergarten class because she missed her mom. In middle school, she was a cheerleader in little pleated skirts. Even while playing school sports, she was always perfectly made up. As Miss Congeniality, she was, quote, radiant in her burgundy form-hugging gown. In other words, the princess belonged in beauty pageants, not boot camp. Quote, "Her fatigue swallowed her like a big frog," Bragg wrote. "She looked like a child who had sneaked into her daddy's closet and tried on his uniform to play soldier," unquote. I Am a Soldier Too seemed an ironic title for a book dedicated to proving the opposite.
You devote the conclusion of your book to sort of talking about the consequences of living with this myth, and I thought you should talk about that. You might want to, the last three or four paragraphs of the book are really terrific, and maybe you want to start by reading that or doing it the other way around, talk about it and then reading it. But, you know, the whole book leads up to not just enumerating how this myth gets played out and the sources of this myth, but it really has this important conclusion, which is that there are very real consequences that we're all living with right now about living in that kind of fiction. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, it would be one thing if these lifestyle stories about return of the manly man or, women baking cookies and going back to the home. There was a lot of this sort of silly stuff. And if it had just remained in that venue, that would be one thing. And it would certainly, would be worth maybe rolling your eyes over, but not getting too overheated. But when our political leaders and our political culture wound up embracing this same myth and determining policy on the basis of it, then we're in very different and sinister territory. The embracing this kind of go-it-alone cowboy ethic, led us into some very dark places. It led us into the erosion of civil liberties. It led us into endorsements of torture, endorsements that were made by media commentators in the early, as much as they would like to forget that period. There were calls for torture, for secret prisons, for the extraordinary renditions, all these things that came to pass. We had a culture cheerleading, a media cheerleading on an administration that was all too glad to put into place policies that they had been eager to pursue in the first place. So living in this myth led us into a disfigurement of our political behavior and a silencing of dissent, and ultimately an undermining of our own security, our own interests, and our moral credibility in the world. And you wanted me to read that?
Yes, that would be great.
The question remains, what if the nation had responded to 9/11 differently? What if we hadn't retreated into platitudes and compensatory fictions? What if we had taken the attack as an occasion to confront the truth? We would, of course, have found much to confront, from malfunctioning radios to inept intelligence to impeachable dishonesties reaching to the highest offices of government. But beyond all these particulars, a larger deception begs to be met head-on. When an attack on home soil causes cultural paroxysms that have nothing to do with the attack, when we respond to real threats to our nation by distracting ourselves with imagined threats to femininity and family life, when we invest our leaders with a cartoon masculinity and require of them bluster in lieu of capacity for rational calculation, and when we blame our frailty on fifth-column feminists. In short, when we base our security on a mythical male strength that can only measure itself against a mythical female weakness, we should know that we are exhibiting the symptoms of a lethal, albeit curable, cultural affliction. Our reflexive reaction to 9/11, fantastical, weirdly disconnected from the very real emergency at hand, exposed a counterfeit belief system. It reprised a bogus security drill that divided men from women and mobilized them to the defense of a myth instead of the defense of a country. That is why, summoned by an hour of danger to unity of purpose, we clung to the fallacy that only a house divided against itself can stand. That self-delusion, so deeply ingrained in our history, so heavily defended by our culture, calls out for refutation. We live at a moment of great possibility. By returning us to the original trauma that produced our national myth, the attacks on 9/11 present us with a historic watershed. Faced with a replay of our formative experience, we have the opportunity to resolve the old story in a new way that honors the country and its citizens. We never really lacked that capacity. We just buried it under a fantasy. September 11 offers us, even now, the chance to revisit that past and reverse that long denial, to imagine a national identity grounded not on virile illusion, but on the talents and vitality of all of us equally, men and women both.
You said in the LA Times recently that if this book had come out 2 years ago, you think the reception would have been much more hostile than it has been. What do you think's changed in the last couple of years?
Well, I think, you know, starting with Hurricane Katrina, the American electorate could no longer, you know, buy into the myth that a sort of cowboy bluster was a good substitute for competence and sort of basic, you know, governmental protective measures on a real, you know, in a realistic and substantive way. And in really in the last, you know, year or two, and particularly in the last 6 months, when you look at the polls of American you know, voters' attitudes toward Bush's performance or the Iraq War, you see the signs that people can no longer turn away. Where that, how, you know, willing people will actually be to confront this mythology is, you know, still an open question. But there at least is a deep uneasiness about a guy in a borrowed flight suit, you know, getting us out of trouble.
Let me end with kind of the most, I think what's the most obvious next question, which is the Hillary Clinton question, which is that she's in some ways the obvious tribune to countering this myth. And you can either argue that she is the, precisely because she could be the first woman president in the history of the country, a kind of antithesis to all of what you've been talking about. Or you could also argue that she is compelled by the forces of the culture and society to also become a kind of cowboy, to kind of prove that she's tougher, or at least as tough as the guys. Without asking whom you're going to vote for in the next election.
It's too early.
Where does Hillary Clinton, where do you think Hillary Clinton fits into kind of the mythology, at least, of, you know, of this? So.
Well, you know, I think just the fact that we have a woman who is strong and independent running for president, who is taken seriously and is not does not, you know, utterly terrorize the electorate as it has in the past.
Only a third of the electorate, I think, at the moment. So.
I'm sorry?
Only a third of the electorate she's terrorizing, I think.
Right. So. But they're mostly Republicans, so we won't worry about them. You know, I think there was a poll that just came out today, and this is one of the things of when you're on book tour, you get to read USA Today. There was a USA Today's poll that she's, you know, clearly in the lead and has 50% of the, and I think it's 64% of Democrats said they would enthusiastically support her if she became the candidate, and I think it was 50% who were backing her on the Democratic side. You know, and the other Democratic candidates are also evidence that people are moving away from embracing a kind of cowboy ethic. Hillary Clinton herself, you know, putting aside her, which is difficult to put aside, but insistence on calling the Iranian Revolutionary Guard terrorists. When she was in Oakland a couple of weeks ago, she gave a speech in which she said, you know, if I'm elected, I will put an end to cowboy diplomacy. So these are all signs that we're beginning as a people to partially turn away from this ethic. On the other hand, we have Rudy Giuliani as the front runner on the Republican side, who's very much riding the, you know, I'm Mr. 9/11 ride to the rescue. Never mind that the city leadership is deeply culpable for the deaths of the firefighters who never heard the Mayday and never got out of the building in time as a result. You know, all this said, the problem is that the mythology never seems to go away. It just goes underground, where in many respects it's more dangerous because it's not visible. You know, I feel like all my life I've watched women make great strides in this country only to be thwarted when they hit that invisible wall of resistance. And that force is this reflex I'm talking about, where this, you know, formula where men can only be strong if women are weak. And I suppose if you can say there's a positive side to 9/11, which you really can't say, but it's that reflex was finally out in the open where we could see it. And it gave us this opportunity if we dare to diagnose it, to challenge it. And it really would be a crying shame if we let that opportunity pass us by.
Thank you. Someone has a microphone. We will start on that side.
Hello. Brilliant, brilliant work. Thank you so much. The first point you made confused me a little. You said we were acting as if our home and hearth was attacked when our military and business centers were attacked. And I don't quite understand the distinction as an attack on our community. How was the reaction inappropriate? What is the? Can you clarify that distinction?
Right. Yeah. I guess we didn't get into all the. In the book, there's a vast detail of how the media and then the popular culture turned these stories into domestic dramas, so that there was story after story about how we should respond by having strong, you know, tough. Women are going to want tough husbands who buy guns and protect the home, and that, you know, the whole idea of the security mom, which was the invention of the 2004 campaign, where that supposedly there was this whole, you know, huge female voting bloc that wanted a kind of presidential sheriff in the White House who would protect them because they were afraid in their homes. There were all these stories about, you know, that women were convinced that, you know, marauding terrorists were about to invade the suburbs. So it was as if we felt that it was the home and hearth under attack, and that and beyond that, that it was our the breakdown of you know, quote unquote, traditional family life that had somehow left us vulnerable. There were all these stories about, well, you know, it's the feminization of the American man that has led to this. That feminism has weakened our military, weakened our resolve to fight. That we, you know, we're no longer the sort of tough culture we supposedly used to be. That, you know, so all this didn't seem to comport with the facts of who would, you know, why, where, and when they attacked us.
Yes. It's going to cause you to run back and forth. We're going to try to go equally left and right here for at least geographic purposes and not political purposes.
Hi. I really appreciated the last comments that you made to the question that you asked. I have two related questions. The first is, how do you reconcile the sort of race and gender dialectic that gets formed by using the captive narratives? Especially because, I mean, we know that the Native American attacks on white settler communities were largely exaggerated, and certainly there were white settler attacks that were equally, if not more, brutal on Native communities. And then my second question has to do with, where do women of color fit into your feminist analysis of silencing and erasure? Because I think there's a lot there too, especially when we think about, for example, the black female politician who was the lone person, right, to vote
right.
against the war.
Absolutely.
And, of course, in Jessica Lynch's platoon,
yes.
the Native American woman who was killed, and I think there's still an effort to try to name something after her
right.
in Arizona. So I think there's equal
right.
amounts of
yes.
analysis there, and I just sort of wonder yeah. where they fit in.
Yeah, and I talk about, you're talking about Lori Piastua, the 23-year-old, or she was 23 at the time, Hopi Indian woman, and it's a very interesting story because here you have, with the Jessica Lynch story, there was sort of frantic effort to find a hero. There was one day where she was allowed to be the hero, you know, due to a snafu in translation. They thought she had was, the Washington Post thought she was shooting till her gun emptied, and just, there was this like 24 hours in the, right in the beginning of the news cycle where it seemed that she was going to be this kind of Rambo figure, and military officials and government officials leaped on this immediately and said, no, this is complete, you know, that your source is all wrong, and then the rest of the media jumped on the Washington Post. It was sort of this rare moment of desire to get the story straight in the modern press. The Post retracted the story, ran three apologias by their ombudsman, and then ran a 6,000-word article clarifying still again that no, she was not this heroic figure, which is clearly more than the Washington Post ever did to correct its errors on the WMD story. And then there was sort of attempts to find a male hero in the Jessica Lynch story, which became increasingly ludicrous, including this one soldier who had died in the car with that she had, you know, where she was injured. And there was some report that he had dropped her, he had dropped his duffel bag in front of her. And the media wanted to re-sort of cast this so that he had actually put the duffel bag in front of her to protect her. And Jessica Lynch was dragged out on some show when asked about this, and she sort of said, well, you know, I suppose it protected me, I don't know. And when I interviewed Jessica Lynch about it later, she said, you know, I think he was, there were bullets whizzing by, I don't think this was the first thing on his mind. But in all this like search for a hero, here's Jessica Lynch telling the press over and over again, there is a hero, Lori Piastua. She didn't even have to go to Iraq because when they shipped out, she had been injured in a training exercise. They were in this, you know, they were in the same. They had trained together at Fort Bliss, Lori Piastua said, "No, no, no. If you know my comrade Jessica Lynch is going, I'm going." So here's the single mother who ships out to Iraq when she didn't have to, and then in the as they're driving to, you know, the speed of light to Baghdad, all these trucks were breaking down in the sand, and Jessica Lynch, who was driving this water truck, her vehicle breaks down. Driver after driver speeds past her while she, you know, she's standing by the side of the road waving. It was Lori Piastua who picked her up and saved her. And Lori Piastua, who ultimately died in this, and she was the driver of the Humvee, and she died when it crashed into this tractor trailer. And yet, there was very little made of her courage and her sacrifice. And there was, I could only find one really major profile done on her, and it ran more than a year after the ambush. It was in the in Rolling Stone, and it was aptly titled "The Forgotten Soldier." I was going to answer the other. I'm sorry. You know, on the subject of the Indian attacks, clearly what I'm talking about here is a white mythology based on, you know, their very narrow tunnel vision perspective. You know, the facts are that Indian suffering, Indian casualties in this period were far worse. There, you know, is a long, you know, behind every story of captivity, there's a story of bloody provocation. I mean, Mary Rowlandson was taken captive. Her town was raided in just a couple of months after, you know, white militia had gone into a winter encampment of the same tribe and, you know, sort of slaughtered indiscriminately, burned the place to the ground, and killed what were mostly, I think it was about half, women and children. So yes, this is clearly told from a certain blinkered perspective.
You had done a lot of work, a lot of research on another project before you began this book. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to leave that project and address this material?
I was working on a book about Judy Berry, who was an environmental activist in Northern California, who's was involved in the Earth First movement, and was leading this campaign to save the old-growth redwoods when a bomb went off in her car. And it's a story about the aftermath of that, you know, the FBI arrested her, called her an eco terrorist. There are certain connections here of what, you know, this was of how we define terrorism, and this I came into the story after she died. She actually survived the bombing and then died several years later of cancer. And where I entered in was she originally filed suit against the FBI and the Oakland police who arrested her and called, you know, accused her of being a terrorist. Case actually came to, it was supposed to come to trial right in the fall of 2001, and then because of the charged atmosphere at that time, it was postponed about 6 months, and her estate and her boyfriend at the time, who had also been in the car and who was also an activist, Daryl Cherney, they prevailed in this lawsuit against the FBI and the police. So I was exploring that as a way of talking about the left in America, talking about political movements and what happens to them and how they get quashed. But I think, like a lot of people after 9/11, I wanted to do something. I wanted to contribute in some way to, and the only way I really knew how, which is through some kind of cultural analysis of what we were experiencing. But I do have a large draft in my of this book in my storage closet, which I guess I'm going to be pulling out sometime soon.
Beyond Hillary Clinton, because we don't know how that's going to work out, and that's in the future, but we also have the first woman Speaker of the House, and on the other side, the people that were very close to this whole effort were women. I mean, Condoleezza Rice and Karen Hughes, and I mean, Harriet Myers was nominated to the Supreme Court. Condoleezza Rice was promoted during this time to be, you know, the most, you know, one of the most powerful people. Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, yeah, you know, well, Harriet Myers has since taken a plunge, but you know, it's kind of like saying, you know, the Bush administration is on the forefront of advancing gay rights because they have some, you know, officials in the White House who are gay. I don't think we can judge the Bush administration on the few exceptions. We need to judge them on their broad record, and that record has been pretty abysmal when it comes to women's rights. And moreover, the Bush administration used 9/11 as a justification to further erode those rights. Within weeks after 9/11, the Justice Department deep-sixed these long-standing class action sex discrimination suits, particularly involving law enforcement. They invented the security mom, as this notion that women, you know, would just, you know, were just seeking protection. And as for Karen Hughes, she was perhaps the most celebrated woman in the high levels in the White House for going home. There was the GOP operatives and certainly the media went bananas, giving her hosannas for this great courageous step. I have in the book a sort of classic quote, yet again, Peggy Noonan, who's always, you know, riding to the defense of the Bushies, wrote this kind of jaw-dropping, which I could actually read, praise of, it's homage to Karen Hughes when she went back to Texas, which is I'll just read it. It speaks for itself. When Karen Hughes worked in the White House, she wore hard clothes. She doesn't have to wear makeup now. She can have a soft face. She can wash her face in Dove Foamy Cleanser. Little product placement there. Not sure how much Dove paid for that. Pat it dry, put on a nice smelling moisturizer, and walk onward into the day. She can shop. Shopping is a wonderful thing. By the way, this was in the Wall Street Journal. I guess I should have mentioned that. It's more wonderful if you have money to buy what catches your eye, if you want to own it. But it's also fun if you don't have money. It's really wonderful to just sort of walk along the mall and see what your country is selling, buying, offering. You get to see the other people look at and judge your country's products. You can buy a big soft pretzel at a stand and sit on a bench and watch the mothers and daughters buy shoes together.
I'll lay back there. Okay.
First of all, I've read half your book. It's an excellent book. I'm at the Jessica Lynch part now. It's interesting and it's provocative. But going to your premise about mythology and American mythology, I think that if you look at cultures throughout the world, especially Western cultures, which I am more familiar with, you always have mythology. Mm-hmm. What I think distinguishes the United States of America from those cultures, particularly the European cultures, is the marketing of the American woman. And the marketing of the presidency, the marketing of the tough guy. So I would like to know, how much do you think we, as women, can take responsibility for buying into that marketing? What is beauty? What is intelligence? What is femininity? What is success? All these things that, you know, the woman on the street does not relate those reactions to something that happened in the 18th century. The woman on the street has been had to some extent, because when we were coming up, we thought we were on a road, a certain road to equality. Mm-hmm. And now you see some regression. And the regression seems to me, and I'd like your feedback on this, to come largely from Madison Avenue and Hollywood, which won't let us free. So what do you think about that as far as what's happening in America?
Well, and there's, you're echoing the questions of many people down here, I think. All cultures, of course, have a mythology. I mean, that's the glue of national identity comes is dependent on this sort of creation of a myth that the nation state buys into. And certainly this kind of quest myth, a monomyth, if you want to use Joseph Campbell's term, often takes this gender form of, the young man rides out to seek his fortune and slay dragons and ultimately prevails and comes back and gets the girl. So mythologies are universal, but each culture's mythology is dependent on the particular history and the particular experience of that culture. And in our case, our particular history was one of repeated insecurity in the home, repeated fear of attack on the frontier, repeated captivities and repeated failures to rescue. And out of these apprehensions and anxieties and vulnerabilities, we created over a very long time our particular version of this mythology. So we don't have knights, but we have, cowboys and Indians. As far as the marketing and the power of Madison Avenue and Hollywood and the entertainment industry, which increasingly the media is just a subsidiary of, I often think that in this country we are in a way much more vulnerable to the mythic constructs spun by popular culture, because we don't have the counter to the same degree as older countries, the countervailing forces of traditions of, you know, ancient customs, ancient histories, ancient conventions. We don't have, you know, the highly elaborated class structure, or the pride in our language, or many other things that other countries have. So we cling all the more to and define ourselves all the more by by our popular cultural mythology, which in the last at least century and a half or more is increasingly and almost exclusively a commercial and marketed culture, not a culture that springs from our organic experience as a society.
Last question. Yes.
I was really interested in your conversation around the myth. I guess as you were talking, I was struck by the fact that when you reference the searchers, that's a story told in the 50s, but it's looking backwards. Mm-hmm. So we're here in this moment right now, enacting perhaps a myth that was created for us in the 50s of an even earlier time. But I'm sort of curious about what you think the shelf life of that myth is, at a time when actually a greater number of minorities have a presence within the way we perceive ourselves, mm-hmm. and that's not our myth. I mean, I don't know, that is a uniquely white experience myth. And I guess I'm also interested in the fact that this myth exists at a time, and I agree that the myth exists, but I'm interested by the fact that it exists at a time when America is increasingly becoming irrelevant on the world stage, when we're in a losing war. So I'm just curious to see, when you project forward, what do you think that will look like, or how it will shake down over time?
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, this is, the searchers... Well, there's a long, which I won't go into, but there's I talk about it in the book. The Searchers itself is a rewrite of an actual story in which the story is very different. Very briefly, Cynthia Ann Parker, who ultimately becomes Little Debbie and played by Natalie Wood, was a young woman who was taken captive in the 1830s from her Texas compound. And did not want to come home, married a Comanche warrior, had three children, one of whom became the last famous leader of the Comanches, Quanah Parker, and was pursued by her white rescuers, and ultimately forced a sort of Mille-like massacre where she and a group of Indian women and children were curing beef hide, and the Texas Rangers rode in and basically slaughtered everybody. Nobody was armed, and spared her at the last moment when they saw she had blue eyes. She did not want to rejoin white society, and they dragged her home, and her white family had to lock her indoors to keep her from. She repeatedly tried to run away, and ultimately she was separated from her all of her family except her little daughter, who was in her arms. And ultimately, when her daughter caught influenza and died, and that was sort of the last straw for her, and she stopped eating and essentially starved herself to death. And this is the story on which became The Searchers. So, I titled the book The Terror Dream after... the novel, which was sort of the halfway point between the real story and the movie, in which The John Wayne figure is not the central character. Actually, the John Wayne character ends up getting shot to death in the face by an Indian woman. But there's the main character who becomes just the sidekick in the movie is this young man who is haunted by what he calls the terror dream. And it's a dream of his being, it's a memory, a humiliating memory of himself as a boy hiding in the brush during a battle between an Indian tribe and his community in which his whole family ends up being killed. And, you know, I called it that because I feel that, I mean, it seems to me that we are still haunted by those kinds of humiliations and an inability in the face of fear and vulnerability, which, after all, are human attributes that will continue on for the rest of time. An inability to grapple honestly with them, and that kind of inability leads us again and again and back into this mythology. And as you point out, it's even when it is no longer of any, if it ever was of any, served any point, even when it just completely defies the truth of who we are in the world, and when we are no longer the shining, if we ever were, invincible power, but are we in some ways cling to this myth all the more deeply. But if we're ever to get out of this, you know, this sort of dream state we're in, we must look at the reality of where we are and who we are as a country. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.